Henry and Clanton in the same courtroom gave us $2 million. I love it. Who do you tell? Let's go through Walter Sullivan. Let him find out, because he thinks he's the man around here. Word will spread pretty fast. Not in this town. Chapter 21. The collision of a small car weighing 3,000 pounds with the wheel unit of a loaded boxcar weighing 75 tons created a nasty accident scene. Once it was determined by the first responders that all four occupants were dead, some of the urgency subsided as the crews went about the grim task of prying and cutting out the bodies. Over 24 officers and rescue personnel were at the site, along with other travelers who happened upon the scene and couldn't pass around it. A state trooper took a series of still shots, and a volunteer from a local fire brigade filled four rolls of film with the recovery and cleanup. Early in discovery, Jake obtained sets of all the photos and had them enlarged. Over a three-month period, he meticulously collected the names of the responders and the strangers who watched them work. Identifying the firemen, police, and medics was easy. He spent time in three volunteer firehouses out in the county, as well as two from the town of Clanton. Everyone, it seemed, answered the call. Putting names with the faces of the strangers was a far greater challenge. He was looking for witnesses, anyone who might have seen anything. Hank Grayson, the only known eyewitness, said in his deposition that he thought there was a car behind him, though he made it clear he wasn't certain. Jake went through every photograph and slowly collected the names of the people at the site. Most were from Ford County, and some admitted they showed up when they heard the chatter on their police scanners. At least a dozen were late-night travelers who got stuck on the road during the 3 hours it took to remove the bodies and clear the scene. Jake tracked down each one of these. Not a one had witnessed the accident. Indeed, most arrived long after it happened. But in six of the photos, there was a white man with a bald head who looked out of place. He was about 50, wore a dark suit, white shirt, dark tie, much too nicely dressed for rural Ford County on a Friday night. He stood with other spectators and watched as the firemen cut and sawed to remove the four bodies. No one seemed to know him. Jake asked the first responders about the man, but no one had ever seen him. In Jake's world, he became the mysterious stranger, the man in the dark suit. Melvin Cochran lived a quarter of a mile from the crossing and was awakened that night by sirens. He got dressed, went outside, saw the carnival-like scene down the hill, and grabbed his video camera. As he walked to the scene with the switch on, he began to pass cars parked on the shoulder, all headed east. Once at the scene, he filmed for almost an hour before the battery ran low. Jake got a copy of the video and had watched it frame by frame for hours. The man in the dark suit was in several scenes, observing the tragedy, at times seemingly bored and wanting to move on. As Melvin approached the site, he passed a total of 11 parked vehicles. Jake was able to identify the license plates on seven of them. The others were obscured. Five of the seven were from Ford County, one was from Tyler County, and one was from Tennessee. He doggedly tracked down each one and eventually matched the vehicles with the names and faces of their owners in the crowd. On a wall in a workroom, Jake cut and pasted and pieced together a large composite of the scene with small nameplates for 26 rescue personnel and 32 spectators. Everyone was identified, except the man in the dark suit. The vehicle with Tennessee plates was registered to a food brokerage firm in Nashville. Thus, no individual name was available. For a month, Jake considered this to be a dead end, which didn't bother him. He figured that if the mysterious man had seen anything relevant, he would have spoken to an officer on the scene. But it nagged him. The man had an odd look about him, and Jake was chasing every detail. The case could be the biggest one of his career, and he was determined to know everything about it. He would later curse his curiosity. He finally paid $250 to a private investigator in Nashville and sent him a photo of the mystery man. 2 days later, the investigator faxed Jake a report, one that he at first wanted to destroy. It read, "I went to the corporate address with the photo and asked around. I was directed to the office of Mr. Neil Nickel, a district rep of some sort. He was obviously the man in the photo, and I showed it to him. He was surprised that I had found him, and he asked how I did so. I said I was working for some of the lawyers involved with the case, but did not give any names. We talked for maybe 15 minutes. Nice guy, with nothing to hide. He said he had been to the wedding of a relative down in Vicksburg and was on his way back home. He lives in a suburb of Nashville. Said he was not familiar with Highway 88, but thought it might save some time. As he crossed into Ford County, he began to follow a pickup truck, one that was all over the road. So he backed off and gave the guy plenty of room, said the driver was obviously drunk. As they went down a hill, he saw the highway signs indicating a crossing ahead. Then he saw the red warning lights flashing at the foot of the hill. There was a loud noise. He thought at first it was an explosion of some sort. Then the truck in front of him hit the brakes and swerved. NN stopped in the road and hurried to the scene on foot. The train was still passing. The crossing lights were still flashing red. The warning bell was still ringing. The driver of the truck was yelling at him. Steam and smoke were coming from the wrecked car. He could see small children crushed in the rear seat. The train stopped, then moved backward and cleared the crossing. By then, other drivers were stopping, and before long, the first policeman and ambulance arrived. The road was blocked, and he couldn't pass, so he had no choice but to hang around and watch. For 3 hours. He said it was pretty gruesome watching the recovery of 4 dead people, especially when they pulled the little kids out. Said he had nightmares for weeks, wished he hadn't seen it. I made sure he was clear about the warning lights. He said he heard the driver of the truck tell a state trooper that the lights were not working, and he started to say something, but he refused to get involved. He refuses to get involved now, wants nothing to do with the case. I asked him why, and he said he was involved in a bad car wreck years ago, and he got blamed for it, had to go to trial, and he has a strong dislike for lawyers and courts. Also, NN has a lot of sympathy for the family and doesn't want to hurt their case. Interesting note. He said that a few months ago he was in the area near Clanton, stopped by the courthouse, and asked if he could see the file with the lawsuit. They said it was public record, so he read some of it and was amused to see that the witness, the driver of the pickup, Mr. Grayson, was still saying that the lights were not working. NN definitely wants to stay out of this. When he was sure he wasn't going to vomit, Jake managed to walk gingerly to the sofa and lie down. He pinched his nose and closed his eyes and saw his fortune fly away. Not only was Nickel a far more credible witness, he could confirm that Hank Grayson, their star, was drinking that night. When he could finally move, Jake folded the report into an unmarked envelope, resisted the temptation to burn it, and hid it in a thick law book where maybe it would vanish, or maybe he would just simply forget about it. If Nickel wanted to avoid the trial, that was fine with Jake. They would keep the same secret. The fear, though, was the defense. 7 months into the lawsuit, Sean Gilder had shown little interest in the case and had only gone through the motions of discovery. He had filed one set of standard interrogatories and requested the basic documents. They had agreed to depose a few of the key witnesses. Jake estimated that he had put in 3 times the hours as the defense lawyers, who actually got paid by the hour. If Neil Nichol insisted on lying low, there was a good chance he would not be discovered by anybody working on behalf of the railroad or its insurance company. And barring a sudden change of conscience, he would get his wish of staying out of any lawsuit. So why did Jake spend the next 3 days with a knot in his stomach? The big question was Harry Rex. Should he show him the report and watch him freak out? Or should Jake simply bury it, along with any knowledge of the mysterious eyewitness? The quandary roiled Jake's world for days, but with time, he managed to shove it into another compartment and concentrate on the rest of the case. 2 months later, on January 9th, 1990, to be exact, the issue returned with a vengeance. Sean Gilder filed a second set of interrogatories that sought answers he already had, for the most part. Again, he appeared listless and totally unimaginative. Jake and Harry Rex had become convinced that Gilder was not sandbagging, a common defense tactic. Rather, it appeared as if Gilder was overconfident because of the fact that Taylor Smallwood drove into a moving train. End of case. But the last interrogatory, number 30 in a package of 30, was lethal. It was one that was commonly used, especially by lazy or busy lawyers. It read, "List the full name, complete address, and phone number of any and all persons with knowledge of the alleged facts of this case." Also known as the roundup, it was a much debated and hated tactic that punished lawyers who worked overtime and dug for the facts. Under the rules of discovery, trials were supposed to be free of ambushes. Each side swapped all information, and it was laid in a transparent fashion before the jury. That was the theory, anyway, the goal. But the new rules created unfair practices, and the roundup was widely despised. It said, in other words, work diligently to learn all the facts, then hand them to the other side on a platter. 2 days after receiving the second set of interrogatories, Jake finally placed the investigator's report on the large, messy desk in front of Harry Rex. He picked it up, read it, dropped it, and without hesitation said, "There goes the lawsuit. There goes the case. Why did you find this clown?" "I was simply doing my job." As Jake told the story of finding Nichol, Harry Rex kicked back in his chair and stared at the ceiling. "Devastating," he mumbled more than once. When Jake finished, he mentioned the last set of interrogatories. Without a thought, Harry Rex said, "We are not going to mention this guy, ever, okay?" "Fine with me, as long as we understand the risks." 3 months later, the man in the dark suit was back. As the clerk assembled and organized the crowd of prospective jurors, and as the lawyers in their courtroom suits situated themselves around their tables and dug in for battle, and as the courthouse regulars found their places in the pews and chatted excitedly about the big trial, Sean Gilder stepped over to Jake and whispered, "We need to see the judge. It's important." Jake was half expecting the usual last-minute maneuvering and was not alarmed. "What is it?"
"I'll explain back there."
Jake motioned for Mr. Pete, the ancient courtroom deputy, and said they needed to see Noose, who was still in chambers. 7 lawyers followed Mr. Pete out of the courtroom. They gathered before Judge Noose, who was putting on his black robe and seemed eager to start a big trial. He looked at the grim faces of Sean Gilder, Walter Sullivan, and the other lawyers and said,
"Morning, gentlemen. What's the issue?"
Gilder was holding some papers, and he sort of waved them at His Honor.
"Judge, this is a motion for a continuance that we are filing right now and asking the court to grant."
"Grounds?"
"This may take a few moments, Judge. Perhaps we should sit down."
Noose gestured awkwardly at the chairs around his conference table, and everybody found one.
"Proceed."
"Judge, last Friday, my co-counsel, Mr. Walter Sullivan, was approached by a man who claimed to be an important witness to this accident. His name is Neil Nickel, and he lives near Nashville. Mr. Sullivan?"
Walter eagerly jumped in.
"Judge, the guy walked into my office and said he really needed to talk to me about the case. We had coffee, and he described how he saw the small wood car hit the train on that terrible night. He saw it all. The perfect eyewitness."
Jake's heart and lungs were frozen, and he felt ill. Harry Rex glared at Sullivan and wished he had a gun.
"A crucial issue here is whether or not the warning lights were working properly. The two railroad employees on the train swear they were flashing. One witness says they were not. Mr. Nickel is certain that they were working. However, for reasons he can explain, he did not approach an officer that night and until now has told no one about the incident. Obviously, he's an important witness, one that we should have the right to depose."
Noose said bluntly,
"Discovery is over. The deadline was months ago. Looks like you should have found this witness before now."
Gilder took over.
"True, Your Honor. But there's another problem. Back during discovery, we filed on time some interrogatories, and one requested the names of all witnesses. When Mr. Brigance filed his responses, he did not mention Neil Nickel. Not a word. However, Mr. Nickel will tell you that he was approached last November by a private investigator working for a lawyer in Clanton, Mississippi. Didn't have his name, but it was most certainly not Walter Sullivan. We quickly found the investigator, and he confirmed that he was hired and paid by Jake Brigance. He submitted a 2-page report summarizing what Mr. Nickel had told him."
Gilder paused, rather smugly, and looked at Jake, who was trying mightily to conjure up a believable lie that would extricate him from this catastrophe. But his brain was frozen, and all efforts at creativity failed him miserably. Gilder went on, sinking the knife deeper.
"And so it's obvious, Your Honor, that Mr. Brigance found the eyewitness, Mr. Neil Nickel, and once he realized that the witness was in no way favorable, but actually quite adverse to his cause, he conveniently tried to forget about him. He violated our rules of discovery by trying to hide a crucial witness."
Harry Rex was far more crooked and devious than Jake, and turned to him and said,
"I thought you supplemented those responses."
It was the perfect and perhaps only statement to interject. Answers to interrogatories were routinely amended and supplemented as more information became available. But Harry Rex was a divorce lawyer and thus accustomed to bluffing around judges. Jake, though, was an amateur. He managed to mumble,
"I thought so, too."
But it was a pathetic effort and not at all believable. Sean Gilder and Walter Sullivan both laughed, and the other three dark suits on their side of the table joined in the awful humor. Judge Noose held the motion and looked at Jake in disbelief. Sean Gilder said,
"Oh, right. I'm sure you wanted to supplement and hand us Neil Nickel, but you forgot. And you've been forgetting for 5 months now.
Nice try, gentlemen. Judge, we have the right to depose this man."
Judge Noose raised a hand and demanded silence.
For a long moment, maybe two or three, or it could have been an hour as far as Jake was concerned, he read the motion for a continuance and began to slowly shake his head. Finally, he looked at Jake and said,
"This appears to be a rather obvious effort on the part of the plaintiff to hide a witness. Jake?"
Jake almost said something like, "Not at all, Your Honor," but he held his tongue. If the investigator was sleazy enough to reveal the name of the lawyer who hired him, then he probably sent Sean Gilder a copy of his report. When Gilder produced it, the axe would fall again. Jake shrugged and said, "Don't know, Judge. I thought we supplemented. Must have been an oversight." Noose frowned and fired back.
"That's hard to believe, Jake. An oversight for a witness this important? Don't feed me a line, Jake. You found a witness that you wished you hadn't found. Then you violated a rule of discovery. I'm appalled by this."
Not even Harry Rex could rescue him with a snappy retort. All five defense lawyers were grinning like idiots as Jake slid lower into his chair. Noose tossed the motion under the table and said,
"Certainly, you have the right to depose this witness. Any idea where he might be?"
Quickly, Walter Sullivan said, "He left for Mexico on Saturday for 2 weeks.
Harry Rex blurted, "Courtesy of Central and Southern Railroad?"
"Hell no, it's his vacation, and he said he's not giving depositions down there."
Noose waved a hand.
"Enough. This complicates matters, gentlemen. I'm going to allow this witness to be deposed at a time that's convenient for everyone. So I'll grant the motion for a continuance."
Gilder pounced with, "Judge, I've also prepared a motion for sanctions. This is an egregious breach of ethics on the part of the plaintiff's lawyers, and it will cost money to reconvene somewhere to have a chat with Mr. Nickel. They should be required to pay for it and cover the expenses."
Noose shrugged and said,
"But you're getting paid anyway."
"Just double bill them," Harry Rex said, "same as always."
Jake lost his cool and said, "Why should we be required to hand over information that you couldn't find if you'd hired the FBI? You guys sat on your asses for the first 7 months and did nothing. Now you want us to feed you our work product."
"So you admit you concealed the witness?" Gilder asked.
"No, the witness was there at the scene and at home in Nashville. You just couldn't find him.
And you violated the discovery rule. It's a bad rule and you know it. We learned that in law school. It protects lazy lawyers.
I resent that, Jake."
Noose raised both hands and settled things down. He rubbed his jaw and after some serious thinking said,
"Well, obviously we cannot proceed today, not with such an important witness out of the country. I'll postpone the trial and allow you gentlemen time to finish discovery. You're dismissed."
Jake said, "But Judge, we should at—"
Noose cut him off with, "No, Jake, nothing further. I've heard enough. Please, you're all dismissed."
The lawyers stood, some quicker than others, and filed out of chambers. At the door, Walter Sullivan said to Harry Rex,
"What are your plans with that $2 million verdict?"
Sean Gilder laughed. Jake managed to step between the two before Harry Rex could throw a punch. Chapter 22. He should have lingered and at least attempted to offer words of explanation to Steve Smallwood, Taylor's brother and the family's spokesman. He should have given instructions to Portia, who was dumbfounded. He should have huddled with Harry Rex and agreed when to meet again to curse and throw things. He should have said goodbye, see you later, to Murray Seilerberg and his team scattered throughout the courtroom. He should have circled back to Noose's chambers and perhaps apologized or tried to make amends. Instead, he bolted for a side door and was out of the courthouse before most of the prospective jurors left the courtroom. He went to his car and hurried away from the square, taking the first road out of town. At the edge of Clanton, he stopped at a convenience store and bought some peanuts and a soda. He had not eaten in hours. He sat by the gas pumps, ripped off his tie, then took off his coat and listened as his car phone rang. It was Portia, at the office, and he was certain she was calling about something he had no desire to deal with. He drove south and was soon close to Lake Chatula. He parked in a rest area on a bluff and looked at the large, muddy lake. He checked the time, 9:45, and knew that Carla would be in class. He had to call her, but wasn't sure what to say. "Well, dear, I tried to hide a crucial witness whose testimony would kill our case." Or, "Well, dear, those damn insurance lawyers outfoxed me again and caught me cheating with discovery." Or, "Well, dear, I violated the rules and now the case has been postponed and we're screwed." He drove here and there, east and west, staying on narrow shaded lanes that wound through the county. He finally called the office and was informed by Portia that Dumas Lee had been hanging around smelling a story and that Steve Smallwood had stopped by in a foul mood and was looking for answers. Lucian wasn't in, and Jake instructed her to lock the door and take the phone off the hook. He vowed again to get rid of the red sob because it was so conspicuous, a veritable bullseye, and at the moment, the last thing he wanted was to be noticed. He wanted to take another turn and drive south for hours until he hit the Gulf. Then maybe he would just keep going off a pier and into the ocean. He could not remember a time in his life that he had so desperately wanted to run away, to disappear. His phone startled him. It was Carla. He grabbed it and said hello.
"Jake, where are you? Are you okay? I just talked to Portia."
"I'm okay. Just taking a drive, trying to avoid the office."
"She said the case has been postponed."
"That's it. Postponed."
"Can you talk?"
"Not now. It's a bad story and will take some time to go through it. I'll be home this afternoon when you get there."
"Okay, but you're fine."
"I'm not going to kill myself, Carla, if that's what you're worried about. Maybe I've thought about it, but I'm under control. I'll see you this afternoon and explain everything." That was a conversation he would love to avoid. "Yes, honey, I cheated and big time, and I got caught." The lawyers would gather one day to depose Neil Nickel, though Sean Gilder would, as always, stall as long as possible. Now that he had the upper hand, and now that Jake would not be screaming for a trial, it would be months before the deposition took place. And Nickel would no doubt be a superb witness, well-dressed and articulate, and thoroughly believable. He would discredit Hank Grayson, bolster the testimony of the engineer, and lend enormous credence to the railroad's theory that Taylor Smallwood was either asleep or thoroughly distracted when he drove into the train. The case was over, plain and simple. The case of a lifetime, or at least a career, had just gone down the toilet, flushed by the ambitions and greed of a lawyer who deliberately sidestepped the rules and arrogantly believed he wouldn't get caught. The litigation loan was at $70,000. He glanced at his watch, 10:05. At that moment, he should have been standing before the panel of prospective jurors. 80 had arrived that morning, and Jake knew all 80 names, knew where they lived, worked, worshipped. He knew where some were born, knew where some of their families were buried. He knew their ages, skin color, some of their children. He, Harry Rex, and Murray Seilerberg had spent hours secluded in the workroom memorizing all the data the team had gathered. There was not another decent case in his office, and he was behind on his bills. He was arguing with the IRS. A road sign pointed to Caraway, his hometown. He turned in the other direction, fearful that his mother might see him driving aimlessly around on a beautiful Monday morning in late April. And now he was stuck with Drew Gamble and a losing case that would only drain away time and money, not to mention causing a lot of bad will around town. He didn't deliberately drive through Pine Grove, but he passed the settlement anyway and was close to the Good Shepherd Bible Church before he realized it. He pulled into the gravel lot with the idea of turning around, but caught a glimpse of a woman sitting at a picnic table near the small cemetery behind the church. It was Josie Gamble, reading a book. Kira came into view and sat near her mother. Jake switched off his engine and decided to have a chat with two people who knew nothing of his morning's disaster, nor would they care. As he walked over, they smiled and were obviously pleased to see him. But then Jake figured they would be happy to see any visitor.
"What brings you out here?"
Josie asked. "Just passing through," he said as he sat across the table. An old maple tree shaded them. "How are you doing, Kira?"
"I'm okay,"
she said and blushed. Under her loose sweatshirt, there were no signs of her pregnancy. Josie said,
"I've never known anyone to just pass through Pine Grove."
"It happens. What are you reading?" She folded a page in the paperback and said,
"A History of Ancient Greece. Pretty exciting stuff. Let's just say the church's library is rather small."
"You read a lot?"
"Well, Jake, I think I told you that I spent 2 years in prison in Texas. 741 days. I read 730 books. When they released me, I asked if I could stay 2 more weeks so I could average a book a day. They said no."
"How do you read a book a day?"
"You ever spent time in prison?"
"Not yet."
"Granted, most of them were not that thick or complicated. One day I read 4 Nancy Drew mysteries."
"Still a lot of books. Do you read, Kira?" She shook her head and looked away. Josie said,
"When I went in, I could barely read. But they had a decent education program. Got my GED and started reading. The more I read, the faster I got. We saw Drew yesterday."
"How was that?"
"It was nice. They let us all 3 sit together in a little room, so we got to hug him and give him kisses. Oh, at least I did. A lot of tears, but we managed a few laughs too. Didn't we, Kira?"
She nodded and smiled, but said nothing.
"It was real sweet. They let us visit for over an hour, then ran us off. I don't like that jail, you know."
"You're not supposed to like it."
"Guess not. Now they're talking death row. They can't really send him away, can they?"
"They'll certainly try. I saw him last Thursday."
"Yeah, he said you hadn't been by in a few days. Said you had a big trial coming up. How'd it go?"
"Is he taking his meds?"
"Says he is. Says he feels a lot better."
Her voice cracked, and she covered her eyes for a moment.
"He looks so little, Jake. They got him wearing some old faded orange coveralls. Says county jail across the back and front. The smallest they had, and still way too big. Got his sleeves and pants rolled up. Damn things just swallow him. And he just looks like a little boy because that's what he really is. Just a kid. And now they want to put him in the gas chamber. I can't believe this, Jake."
Jake glanced at Kira, who was wiping her cheeks too. "These poor people." Another car pulled into the parking lot. Josie watched it and said,
"That's Mrs. Golden, the tutor. She's coming 4 days a week now. Says Kira is catching up."
Kira stood and, without a word, walked to the door of the church and hugged Mrs. Golden, who waved at them. They went inside and closed the door. "She's nice to do this," Jake said.
"I can't believe how wonderful this church is, Jake. We live here for free. They're feeding us. Mr. Thurber, who's a foreman at the feed mill, got it worked out so I can do 10 to 20 hours a week. It's only minimum wage, but I've worked for that before."
"That's good news, Josie."
"If I have to work 5 jobs and do 80 hours a week, I swear I'll do it, Jake. She is not having that baby and ruining her life."
Jake put up his hands in mock surrender.
We've had this conversation, Josie, and I really don't want to go through it again.
I'm sorry.
For a long time, nothing was said. Jake gazed across the cemetery to the hills beyond it. Josie closed her eyes and seemed to meditate. Jake finally stood and said, "I need to be going." She opened her eyes and flashed a pretty smile.
"Thanks for stopping by."
"I think she needs counseling, Josie."
"Hell, don't we all?"
"She's been through a lot. She was raped repeatedly, and now she's enduring another nightmare. Her situation is not going to improve."
"Improve? How can we improve, Jake? That's easy for you to say."
"Do you mind if I talk to Dr. Rooker, the psychiatrist who examined Drew over in Tupelo?"
"And talk about what?"
"About seeing Kira."
"Who's going to pay for it?"
"I don't know. Let me think about it."
"You do that, Jake."
There was nothing pleasant waiting at the office, and Jake wanted to avoid the square anyway. If he bumped into Walter Sullivan, he might throw a punch. And by now, every lawyer in town knew the gossip, knew that Brigance had been bounced out of court and had somehow managed to screw up Smallwood, the case they had all coveted. Only two or three of the 30 or so lawyers in town would truly be sad at the news. Some would be downright gleeful, and that was fine with Jake, because he despised them too. Lost on the back roads, he called Lucian. He parked in the drive behind the 1975 Porsche Carrera with 1,000,000 miles on it and trudged along the sidewalk to the steps of the sweeping old porch that wrapped around the first level of the house. Lucian's grandfather had built it just before the Great Depression with the intention of having the most magnificent home in town. It sat on a hill, 0.5 mile from the courthouse, and from the front porch where he spent his time, Lucian looked down on his neighbors. He had inherited the house, along with the law firm, in 1965, when his father died suddenly. He was waiting, rocking, always reading a thick book of nonfiction, always with a glass on the table next to him. Jake fell into a dusty wicker rocker on the other side of the table and asked, "How can you start the day with Jack Daniels?"
"It's all about pacing, Jake. I talked to Harry Rex."
"Is he okay?"
"No. He's worried about you. Thought maybe they'd find you in the woods with the motor running and a garden hose stuck in the tailpipe."
"I'm thinking about it."
"You want a drink?"
"No, I do not. But thanks."
"Sally's grilling pork chops, and we have fresh corn from the garden."
"I didn't want her to cook."
"That's her job. And I eat lunch every day." "What in hell were you thinking?"
"Maybe I wasn't." Sally appeared around a corner and ambled toward them in her usual confident way, as if time meant nothing, and she ruled the house because she had been sleeping with the boss for over a decade. She wore one of her short white dresses that made the most of her long brown legs. She was always barefoot. Lucian had hired her as a housekeeper when she was 18 years old, and she had soon been promoted.
"Hello, Jake," she said with a smile.
No one considered her a mere house servant, and she had not said the words Mr. or Mrs. in years.
"Something to drink?"
"Thanks, Sally. Just some iced tea. No sugar." She disappeared.
"I'm listening," Lucian said.
"Maybe I don't want to talk about it."
"Well, maybe I do. Did you really think you could hide an eyewitness in such a major lawsuit?"
"It wasn't so much hiding as it was just hoping he would stay away." Lucian nodded and put his book on the table. He lifted his glass and took a sip. He looked cold sober, no red eyes or nose. Jake was sure his innards were pickled, but Lucian was a legendary drinker who could hold his liquor with anyone. He smacked his lips and said,
"Harry Rex told me you guys made the decision together."
"That's awfully big of him."
"I probably would have done the same thing. It's a bad rule that lawyers have hated forever."
There wasn't the slightest doubt in Jake's mind that Lucian would have laughed at Sean Gilder's interrogatories and declined to identify any and all troublesome witnesses. The difference was that Lucian would not have located someone like Neil Nickel to begin with. Jake stumbled across him because he was being too thorough.
"You got a best-case scenario?" Lucian asked. "Harry Rex did not."
"Not really. Maybe we depose the witness and he's not as solid as we fear. Then we go to trial something like 6 months from now. We've paid the experts, so they'll be on board. The jury guy will cost us another bundle if we use him. The facts haven't changed, though a couple have shifted a little. The crossing is dangerous. Its warning light system was antiquated and poorly maintained. The railroad knew it had a problem and refused to fix it. 4 people were killed. We'll get to the jury and roll the dice."
"How much do you owe?"
$70,000.
"You're kidding. $70,000 in litigation expenses?"
"That's not unusual these days."
"I never borrowed a dime on a lawsuit."
"That's because you inherited money, Lucian. Most of us are not so lucky."
"My office, crazy as it was, always showed a profit."
"You ask for the best case scenario. You see a better one?" Sally came back with a tall glass of iced tea and some lemon.
"Lunch in 30 minutes, she said, as she disappeared again.
"You haven't asked for my advice yet."
"Okay, Lucian. Got any advice?"
"You gotta go after this new guy. There's a reason he held back, and a reason he came forward."
"He told the investigator he got sued one time and hates lawyers."
"Go after him. Find out everything about that lawsuit. Find the dirt, Jake. You gotta bury this guy in front of the jury."
"I don't want to go to court. I'd like to be trout fishing in some secluded mountain stream. That's all I want." Lucian took another sip and returned his glass to the table.
"You talked to Carla?"
"Not yet. I will when she gets home. What fun, telling my wife, a person I adore, that I got caught cheating and tossed out of court."
"I never did well with wives."
"You think the railroad would settle?"
"Don't think like that, Jake. Don't ever show weakness. You can rebound from this by pushing hard again, squawking at Noose until he gives a new trial date, and drag those sumbitches back into court. Attack the new witness. Pick a good jury. You can handle this, Jake. No talk of settling."
For the first time in hours, Jake managed a chuckle. The Hocut House had been built a few years before Lucian's. Thankfully, Old Man Hocut didn't care for yard work, so he selected a small city lot for his fine new home. Jake didn't care for it either, but once a week, during warm weather, he pulled out the lawnmower and edger and spent a couple of hours sweating. Monday afternoon seemed like a good time, and he was in the backyard laboring away when his girls got home from school. He was never there waiting for them, and Hannah was thrilled to see her father at home so early. He had cans of lemonade in a cooler, and they sat on the patio and talked about school until Hannah got bored with the adults and went inside.
"Are you okay?"
Carla asked with great concern.
"No."
"You want to talk?"
"Only if you promise to forgive me."
"Always."
"Thanks.
It might be difficult."
She smiled and said,
"I'm with you, okay?"
Chapter 23. Of the 3 jailers who came to his cell with meals and instructions, room checks and lights out, and occasionally a kind word, Mr. Zack was his favorite, because he seemed to care. His voice was never harsh like the others. Sergeant Buford was the worst. He had once told Drew that he'd better enjoy the county jail because death row was a terrible place, and that's where all cop killers were sent to die. Mr. Zack arrived early with a tray of food, scrambled eggs, and toast. He left it by the bunk and returned with a grocery bag and said,
"Your preacher brought these by. Some clothes, real clothes, that you need to put on and get dressed up."
"Why?"
"Because you're going to court today. Didn't your lawyer tell you?"
"Maybe. I don't remember. What am I doing in court?"
"Hell if I know. I just handle a jail. When did you shower last?"
"I don't know. Don't remember."
"I think it was 2 days ago. You're okay. You don't smell too bad."
"The water was ice cold. I don't want a shower."
"Then eat up and get dressed. They're coming to get you at 8:30.
When the jailer was gone, Drew chewed on a piece of toast and ignored the eggs. They were always cold, too. He opened the grocery sack and removed a pair of jeans, a thick plaid shirt, 2 pairs of white socks, and a pair of scuffed white sneakers, all obviously hand-me-downs, but smelling like strong detergent. He stepped out of his orange coveralls and got dressed. Everything fit reasonably well, and he liked the fact that he was wearing real clothes again. He had one change in a cardboard box under his bunk where he kept his other valuables. He retrieved a small bag of salted peanuts his lawyer had brought him and ate them slowly, one at a time. He was supposed to read for an hour each morning, strict instructions from his mother. She had delivered 2 books, one, a history of the state, that he had used in class and found incredibly boring. The other was a novel by Charles Dickens that his English teacher sent via his preacher. He had little interest in reading either one. Mr. Zack returned to fetch his tray and said,
"You didn't eat your eggs."
Drew ignored him and stretched out on the bottom bunk for another nap. Minutes later, the door burst open and a thick deputy growled,
"Get up, kid."
Drew scrambled to his feet as Marshal Prather slapped cuffs on his wrists, yanked him by an elbow, and led him out of the cell, down the hall, and out the back door where a patrol car was waiting with Dwayne Looney behind the wheel. Prather shoved Drew into the rear seat, and they sped away. The prisoner peeked out a window to see if anyone was watching. Moments later, they wheeled to a stop near the rear door of the courthouse where 2 men with cameras were waiting. With a slightly softer touch, Prather pulled Drew out and made sure he faced the cameras for full frontal shots. Then they were inside and climbing a dark, narrow staircase. Jake sat on one side of the table, Lowell Dyer the other. Judge Noose was at the end, no robe, unlit pipe stuck between his teeth. All 3 men were frowning and apparently unhappy, each for different reasons. Noose placed some papers on the table and rubbed his eyes. Jake was irritated at even being there. The event was nothing but a first appearance for several freshly indicted defendants, and Jake had tried to waive it on behalf of Drew. However, his honor wanted to be seen doing his job, presiding over the criminals and keeping them locked up. A crowd was expected, and Jake cynically believed Noose wanted to look good for the voters. Jake, of course, wasn't worried about the voters, and he had accepted the fact that he was about to look bad, regardless of what happened. He would sit next to the defendant, stand next to him, consult with him, speak for him, and so on. The clear and obvious guilt of Drew Gamble was about to rub off on his lawyer. Jake said, "Judge, I need to hire a psychiatrist for my client, and the state cannot expect me to pay for one."
"He just came back from Whitfield. Didn't he see the experts down there?"
"He did. However, they work for the state, and the state is prosecuting him. We need our own private shrink."
"I certainly do," Lowell mumbled.
"So this is headed toward an insanity defense?"
"Probably. But how can I make that decision without consulting with our own psychiatrist?
I'm sure Lowell will be able to line them up in court and produce several experts from Whitfield who'll say the kid knew precisely what he was doing when he pulled the trigger. Lowell shrugged and nodded his agreement. Noose was perplexed and said, "Let's talk about this later. I'd like to discuss our timing here and at least get a tentative trial date. Summer is approaching, and it usually complicates our calendars. Jake, what are you thinking?"
Oh, lots. For one, his star witness was pregnant, but still hiding it well. He was under no obligation to inform anyone of this. Indeed, it was likely that the state would call Kira to the stand before Jake did. After long conversations with Portia and Lucian, Jake had decided that the better strategy was to push for a trial in late summer so that she would be visibly pregnant when she testified. The complicating factor was the threat of an abortion. Josie was working two minimum wage jobs, and she owned a car. Nothing prevented her from grabbing her daughter and going to Memphis for an abortion. The topic was so raw that it was not being discussed. Second, little Drew Gamble was finally growing up. Jake was watching him carefully, as was his mother, and both had noticed some small pimples on his cheeks and a dash of new peach fuzz above his lips. His voice was changing, too. He was eating more and had gained 5 pounds, according to the jailer. Jake wanted a small kid sitting in the defendant's chair at trial, not a gangly teenager trying to look older. "The sooner the better. Late summer, maybe."
"Lowell?" "There's not a lot of preparation, Judge. Not many witnesses. We should be ready to go in a couple of months."
Noose studied his docket and finally said,
"Let's say Monday, August 6th, and set aside the entire week."
3 months away. Kira would be 7 months along. Jake still could not envision the drama in the courtroom when she testified that she was indeed pregnant and Kofor was the father because he had repeatedly raped her. What a nasty trial. Drew was cuffed to a wooden chair in a small dark holding room with two other criminals, both fully grown black men who were amused by the age and size of their new colleague. Their crimes seemed insignificant, unimpressive. One said,
"Say, Drew, you shot that deputy."
Drew had been lectured by his lawyer to say nothing, but in the presence of other handcuffed men, he felt safe.
"That's right. With his own gun. The only gun I could find. He really pissed you off. He beat my mother. I thought she was dead."
"They're gonna fry your ass in the electric chair."
"I think it's the gas chamber," the other said.
Drew shrugged as if he wasn't sure. The door opened and a bailiff said,
"Bowie."
One of the men stood as the bailiff took him by the elbow and led him away. When the door was closed, the room was dark again, and Drew asked,
"What are you in for?"
"Stole a car. Wish I'd shot a cop."
Small packs of lawyers were hovering around the courtroom as defendants were being processed. Some of the lawyers actually had business there. Others were part of the courthouse crowd that never missed a show. The rumors were that the kid would finally make a public appearance, and this drew them like vultures to a carcass. When Jake emerged from Noose's chambers, he was impressed with the number of people there to witness preliminary hearings that meant little on the road to justice. Josie and Kira were huddled in the front row with Charles and Meg McGarry, and all four looked terrified. Across the aisle, there was a pack of Kofors and friends, all angry. Dumas Lee was sniffing around with another reporter. Judge Noose called the name of Drew Allen Gamble, and Mr. Pete left to find him. They emerged from a side door next to the jury box and paused for a moment to remove the handcuffs. Drew looked around and tried to absorb the enormity of the room and all the people gawking at him. He saw his mother and sister sitting out there, but was too stunned to smile.
Mr. Pete led him to a spot in front of the bench, where Jake met him, and they looked up at the judge. Jake was 6 feet tall. Mr. Pete was at least 6'1", and both seemed at least a foot taller than their defendant. Noose looked down and said, "You are Drew Allen Gamble." Drew nodded and might have spoken.
"Please speak up, sir,"
Noose almost yelled into his microphone. Jake looked down at his client.
"Yes, sir."
"And you are represented by the Honorable Jake Brigance, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you have been indicted by the grand jury of Ford County for the murder of Officer Stuart Kofer, right?"
In Jake's biased opinion, Noose was being far too dramatic and playing to the crowd. Hell, the entire first appearance could have been dispensed with a signature.
"Yes, sir."
"And you have a copy of the indictment?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you understand the charges?"
"Yes, sir."
As Noose ruffled some papers, Jake wanted to say something like, "Come on, Judge. How can he not understand the charges? He's been locked up for over a month." He could almost feel the stares drilling into the back of his nice gray blazer, and he knew that this day, May 8th, was the day when he was unofficially crowned the most despised lawyer in town. His Honor asked,
"Do you plead guilty or not guilty?"
"Not guilty."
"Okay. You will be remanded to the custody of the Sheriff's Department and await trial for the murder of Stuart Kofer. Anything else, Mr. Brigance?"
"Anything else? Hell, we didn't need this."
"No, sir." "Take him away."
Josie was trying to control herself. Jake walked back to the defense table and tossed down a useless legal pad. He glanced at Pastor McGarry, then looked directly at the Kofer gang. 2 weeks earlier, Lowell Dyer had informed Jake that he and his investigator would like the opportunity to meet with Josie and Kira and ask questions. It was quite a professional move, because Dyer didn't need Jake's permission to talk to anyone except the defendant. Jake represented Drew, not his family, and if anyone working for law enforcement or the prosecution wanted to chat with a potential witness, they could certainly do so. Unlike civil litigation, where all witnesses were made known and their testimonies probed long before trial, in criminal matters, neither side was required to reveal much of anything. In a simple divorce case, every dollar was accounted for in theory. But in a capital murder trial with a human life on the line, the defense was not entitled to know what the accusing witnesses might say or what opinions the experts might put forth. Jake agreed to arrange a meeting in his office and invited Ozzie and Detective Rady as well. He wanted a crowded room because he wanted both Josie and Kira to experience the tension of discussing what had happened before an audience. Noose adjourned for lunch at 11:30. Jake and Portia walked Josie and Kira across the street and were followed by Dyer and his investigator. They reconvened in the main conference room where Bev had laid out coffee and brownies. Jake arranged everyone around the table and sat Josie at one end, alone, as if on the witness stand. Lowell Dyer was warm and pleasant and began by thanking her for her time. He had the full report from Detective Rady and knew a lot of her background. She kept her responses brief. The day before, Jake had spent 2 hours coaching her and her daughter at the church. He had even written instructions for them to review, gems such as, "Keep your answers brief. Don't volunteer anything. If you don't know, don't guess. Do not hesitate to ask Mr. Dyer to repeat the question. Say as little as possible about the physical abuse. We'll save it for trial. And most important, always remember that he is the enemy, and he is trying to put Drew on death row." Josie was tough and had been around the block. She got through the questions without emotion and gave only the barest of details about the beatings. Kira was next. For the occasion, and at Jake's request, she wore jeans and a tight blouse. At 14, no one would have suspected that she was 4 months pregnant. Jake had readily agreed to the meeting because he wanted Lowell Dyer to have the opportunity to evaluate the witness before she began showing. On her list of instructions, Portia had typed in bold letters, "Do not mention your pregnancy. Do not mention the rapes. If asked about physical abuse, start crying and don't answer. Jake will intervene." Her voice broke almost immediately, and Dyer didn't push. She was a frightened, fragile child who was now secretly carrying one of her own and seemed thoroughly overwhelmed. Jake grimaced, shrugged, said to Dyer, "Maybe another time."
"Sure."
Chapter 24. Jake had been careful not to get himself photographed around the courthouse. Evidently, the editor of the Times went to the archives and selected one of 100 from the trial of Carl Lee Haley 5 years earlier. He plastered it on the front page next to one of Drew in handcuffs getting out of the patrol car the day before. Side by side, cop killer and lawyer. Each as guilty as the other. Jake poured a cup of coffee in his kitchen and read the report by Dumas Lee. An anonymous source said the trial was scheduled for August 6th in Clanton. The news of the location was interesting. Jake planned to do everything in his power to change venue and have the trial as far away from Clanton as possible. He turned back to the front page. He remembered the photo and had rather liked it back then. The caption under it read, "Defense Attorney Jake Brigance." He was all business, with a proper frown that conveyed the seriousness of the moment. Perhaps he appeared a bit thinner, but he knew he weighed the same. 5 years had passed, and the hairline was still receding. He heard thunder and remembered that rain was in the forecast, another wave of spring storms. He had no appointments for the day, and he had no desire to hang out in the coffee shop. So he said, "Screw it," and went to his bedroom, undressed, and crawled under the covers, where he found the warm body of his wife. Good news continued to pour in. Judge News faxed copies of 2 letters to Jake, 15 minutes apart. The first read, "Dear Judge News, as the attorney for the Ford County Board of Supervisors, I have been asked by the board to respond to your request for attorney's fees for Jake Brigance in the Stuart Cofer matter. As you well know, Section 99-15-17 of the Mississippi Code clearly states that the maximum to be paid by the county for the representation of indigents charged with capital murder is $1,000. There is no language in that statute that gives the board the discretion to pay more. There should be, and we both know that the limit is not sufficient. However, I've discussed this matter with the board, all 5 members, and it is their position that the maximum compensation will be $1,000. I know Jake well, and am happy to discuss this with him. Sincerely, Todd Tannehill, Attorney at Law." The second letter was from Sean Gilder, attorney for the railroad, and it read, "Dear Judge News, it is with a heavy heart that I write to inform you that one of our experts, Dr. Crow Ledford, died suddenly last week, just moments after completing the Key West Marathon. The cause is suspected to be cardiac arrest. Dr. Ledford was a professor at Emory University and an esteemed expert in the field of highway and railroad safety. His testimony was to be the cornerstone of our defense. Though no trial date has been set, we will obviously need additional time to find and hire an expert to replace Dr. Ledford. Our apologies to the court. I will contact Mr. Brigance and tell him this awful news. Sincerely, Sean Gilder."
Jake tossed the letter onto his desk and looked at Portia. A dead expert will buy them another 6 months. She said,
Boss, we need to talk.
Jake glanced at his door and said, It's closed. What's up?
Well, I've been working here for almost 2 years.
And you're ready to become a partner?
No, not yet. But I plan to take over after law school.
You can have it.
Anyway, I'm worried about this place. I've looked at the phone records for the first 3 months of this year and compared them to the last 6 weeks. Boss, the phone isn't ringing.
I know that, Portia.
And worse, the foot traffic has really slowed. On average, we open one new file each day, 5 a week, 20 a month. And we keep about 50 active. In the past 6 weeks, we've opened 7 new files, most for small stuff like shoplifters and no-fault divorces.
That's my practice.
Seriously, Jake, I'm worried.
Thank you, Portia. But I don't want you worrying. That's my job. You learn quick in this business that it's feast or famine.
When's the feast?
We'll get $1,000 for gamble.
Seriously, Jake.
I appreciate your concern, but let me handle it. You have your sights set on law school in August, and that's enough to keep you busy. She took a deep breath and tried to smile.
I think the town has turned against you, Jake.
He paused long enough to acknowledge it, then said, It's temporary. I'll survive, Gamble. Then I'll settle Smallwood. A year will pass, and everybody will be clamoring for my services. I promise you, Portia, when you finish law school, I'll still be here suing people.
Thanks.
Please, go worry about something else. With her mother working sporadic hours at both the feed mill and a chicken processing plant, Kira got bored in the afternoons and hung around the parsonage tending to Justin, the McGarrys' 4-year-old. Meg, now 8 months pregnant, was taking classes at a junior college and appreciated the babysitting. Often, when she was home, they went for long walks down a gravel road behind the church, with Justin ahead of them on his little bike. They liked to stop at a bridge over Carter's Creek and watch him play in the shallow water. Kira adored Meg and talked to her about things her mother wouldn't understand. The abortion had been off-limits for some time, but Meg and Charles were watching the calendar and knew the timing was becoming crucial. Kira was mid-term, and a decision had to be made. Sitting on the edge of the bridge with their feet hanging down, Meg said,
Does Josie still want you to get an abortion? She says she does, but we can't pay for one. What do you want, Kira?
I don't want to have a baby, that's for certain. But I really don't want to go through an abortion. Mom says it's not a big deal. Can I tell you a secret?
You can tell me anything.
I know. Mom says she got an abortion one time after Drew and I were born. Says there's nothing to it.
Meg tried to hide her shock that her mother would tell her 14-year-old daughter such a secret.
That's not true, Kira. Not at all. Having an abortion is a horrible thing to do, and the damage lasts for many years. As Christians, we believe that life begins at conception. The 2 children you and I are carrying right now are living beings, little gifts from God. Having an abortion terminates a life. So you think it's murder?
I do. I know it is.
I don't want to do it.
Is she pressuring you?
All the time. She's afraid she'll get stuck raising another kid. Can she make me get an abortion?
No.
Can I tell you a secret?
Sure.
That's what we're doing, right?
It is. I talked to Jake off the record and asked him what would happen if Josie took you to a clinic in Memphis and you objected. He said that no clinic, no doctor will perform an abortion if the mother doesn't want it. Don't let her make you do it, Kira.
Kira took her hand and squeezed it. Justin yelled and pointed to a frog at the edge of the water. Meg said,
You're too young to worry about raising a child, Kira. That's why adoption is the best route. There are plenty of young couples out there who desperately want a child. Charles knows other ministers, and he'll have no problem finding the perfect home for your baby. How about a home for us? I'm tired of living in a church. We'll find something. And speaking of church, there is another issue we need to chat about, with your mom, too. You're starting to show, and we're trying to keep this a secret, right? That's what Jake said. It may be time to stop attending services. But I enjoy the services. Everyone is so nice. They are. And they like to talk, same as any small church. If they realize you're pregnant, word will spread like crazy. What am I supposed to do for the next 4 months? Hide in the church kitchen? Let's discuss it with your mother. She'll just say, get an abortion. That's not happening, Kira. You're going to have a healthy baby and make some young couple very happy.
After Hannah was asleep, Jake went to his car, grabbed a bottle of red wine, uncorked it at the kitchen counter, found two seldom-used wine glasses, stepped into the den, and said to his wife, "Meet me on the patio." Outside, she saw the bottle on the table and asked, "What's the occasion?" "Nothing good." He poured two glasses, gave one to her, they clinked, and sat down. "Here's to our pending bankruptcy."
"Cheers, I guess."
Jake took a big gulp. Carla, a much more reasonable sip. He said, "Smallwood just got delayed by months. The county refuses to pay me more than $1,000 for a capital murder defense. The phone has stopped ringing at the office. Josie needs $300 a month to rent a place. And the backbreaker is that Stan at Cabbage called today and his boss wants a payment on our litigation loan."
"How much of a payment?"
"Something like half would make them happy. Half of $70,000. It is, of course, unsecured, and the bank didn't want to make the loan in the first place. Stan says they've never been in the litigation business and are afraid of it. Can't blame them for that."
"I thought they agreed to wait until the case settled."
"Stan did, verbally, but his boss is leaning on him. Remember, they sold out 3 years ago to a bigger bank in Jackson? Stan gets frustrated with some of the decisions down there." Carla took another sip and breathed deeply.
"Okay. I thought Judge Noose had a plan to make sure you got paid."
"He does, but it's a lousy plan. I'm supposed to wait until the trial is over and then sue the county for my time and expenses. He promises to rule in my favor and force the county to pay."
"What's wrong with that?"
"Everything. It means I get nothing for months, nothing to pay the overhead while the practice dries up and the town boycotts me. When I'm forced to sue the county, that'll make the newspaper, so more bad press. And there is really no way Noose can force the county to pay more than $1,000. If the supervisors dig in, and they will, we're screwed." She nodded as if she understood, took another sip, and eventually said,
"Lovely."
"Yes, Noose thinks it's really clever, but then he's desperate for a lawyer to represent the kid."
"Dare I ask how much cash we have right now?"
"Not much. $5,000 in the office account, $8,000 in our money market, $10,000+ in savings." He slurped some more wine. "Pretty pathetic if you think about it. 12 years as a lawyer and only $18,000 socked away."
"We have a good life, Jake. We both work. We live better than most. There is equity in the house, right?"
"A little. We'll have to squeeze out every penny of it to pay Stan."
"A second mortgage?"
"There's no way around it."
"What did Harry Rex say?"
"Well, when he stopped cussing me, we called Stan and they got into it. Harry Rex maintains it's a line of credit with no due date, so the bank will just have to wait. Stan cussed right back and said he would call the entire loan. When I hung up, they were still cussing."
"That's unfortunate."
A moment passed as they listened to the crickets. The street was quiet except for the buzz of insects and the distant barking of a dog. Carla asked,
"Did Josie ask for money?"
"No, but she needs to get away from the church. They're tired of living there, and you can't blame them. Kira is midterm and starting to show. She won't be able to hide it much longer. You can imagine how much fun the busybodies will have when they realize she's pregnant."
"And Josie's found a place?"
"She says she's looking, but she's also working part-time jobs now. She can squeeze together $100 a month for rent. Plus, they don't have a stick of furniture."
"So we're paying rent too?"
"Not yet, but I'm sure we'll have to help. And she has a pile of medical bills that she'll have to bankrupt."
"What about medical care for Kira?"
"Oh, that too." After another long pause, Carla said,
"I have a question."
"Okay."
"Did you buy more than one bottle of wine?"
Chapter 25. 3 days after classes ended, and Hannah and Carla were set free for the summer, the Braganzas loaded themselves and the dog into the car and headed for the beach, their annual vacation. Carla's parents had semi-retired to the Wilmington area and owned a spacious condo on the water in Wrightsville Beach. Hannah and Carla loved the sand and the sun. Jake appreciated the rent-free accommodations. Her father, still Mr. McCullough to Jake, liked to refer to himself as an investor and could bore anyone with the latest earnings reports. He also wrote a column for a minor financial magazine that Jake had once, long ago, subscribed to in a vain effort to understand what the guy was up to. His real motive for the subscription had been to figure out if his father-in-law had serious money. So far, Mr. McCullough's net worth was a mystery, but it was obvious he and his wife were quite comfortable. Mrs. McCullough was a pleasant lady in her mid-60s who was active in all manner of garden clubs, turtle savers, and hospital volunteers. The summer before and the summer before that, the Braganzas had flown from Memphis to Raleigh, where they rented a car for the vacation. Hannah wanted to fly again and was disappointed when she first learned of the family road trip. 12 hours of it. She was too young to know of their belt tightening, and her parents were careful with their words and actions. They planned the trip as a grand adventure and mentioned a few sites they might visit along the way. The truth was that they would take turns driving and hoped their daughter would get plenty of sleep. The Saab stayed home. Carla's car was of a more recent vintage and had far fewer miles. Jake bought new tires and got it serviced properly. Off they went at 7 a.m, with Hannah barely awake under the covers in the back seat and cuddled up with the dog. Jake found a 60s station out of Memphis, and he and Carla hummed along with the oldies as the sun rose before them. They had vowed to keep things light, not only for their benefit, but for Hannah's. The law practice was crumbling around them. The bank wanted money. Smallwood, their pot of gold, had become another kind of train wreck. The gamble trial was 2 months away and loomed like its own execution date. As their income fell, their debts climbed and seemed insurmountable. But they were determined to survive. They were not yet 40 years old, in good health, with a lovely home and plenty of friends and a law office that Jake still believed he could build into something bigger. This would be a difficult year financially, but they would get through it and emerge stronger. Hannah announced she was hungry, and Carla challenged her to select the right breakfast place. She chose a fast food restaurant beside the interstate, and they went through the drive-thru. They were making good time, and Jake wanted to arrive before dark. Mrs. McCullough promised to have dinner on the table. They played car games, card games, pick the billboard games, count the cows games, any kind of game Hannah could think of, and they sang along with the radio. When Hannah drifted off, Carla pulled out a paperback
and everything was quiet. Lunch was a burger at another drive-thru, another place selected by Hannah, and before they drove away, they changed drivers. Carla drove for an hour before getting sleepy. Jake wasn't fond of her driving anyway, so they swapped again. Once in the passenger seat, she came to life and couldn't nap. It was almost 2 p.m., and they had hours to go. Carla looked to make sure Hannah was sound asleep and said,
"Okay, I know we're not talking about this, at least in front of her, but I can't get it off my mind."
Jake smiled and said,